Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today, we are wrestling with, well, a really tough question. How can the wealthiest nation in history still grapple with such huge, persistent poverty?
It's a paradox, isn't it? And Matthew Desmond tackles it head on in his book, Poverty by America.
Yeah, it's a book that really makes you stop and think.
It does. And his answer is pretty stark. It's challenging, especially if you think of yourself as, you know, comfortable or successful in America.
Right. He completely flips the script. Usually we think about poverty as, I don't know, a problem for the poor, maybe bad choices, maybe lack of resources.
Mm-hmm. Or just bad luck.
Exactly. But Desmond argues, no, poverty is actually created by America, by the systems we have in place. He says it's a direct result of policies and choices that actually benefit the affluent.
So our goal in this deep dive is really to unpack that argument. We're looking at the structures Desmond identifies in his sources.
We want to move beyond the usual talk about charity, you know, and look at the systems themselves, the systems of exploitation he talks about.
It's about shifting the focus from just alleviating poverty to demanding justice, systemic justice.
Okay, let's dig in. Maybe start with the author himself, Matthew Desmond.
Sure. So Matthew Desmond is a big name in sociology. He's a professor at Princeton.
Right.
He founded the Eviction Lab, which is huge. It gathers data on evictions across the whole country. And he's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. Mm. So he's got the credentials.
Definitely. And people might know him from his earlier book, Evicted, that won a Pulitzer Prize.
That was such a powerful book. Really immersive.
It was. He did this incredible ethnographic work, living alongside families, going through eviction, documenting their lives.
And that's what makes his perspective so unique, I think. He connects those really personal human stories, the micro level suffering you see in Evicted with the big picture, the macro level analysis in Poverty by America.
Yeah, he links like one family struggling with rent to these massive multi-billion dollar government policies or financial systems.
And he's not afraid to, to point fingers, he directly implicates comfortable middle and upper class Americans. He basically holds up a mirror and says, you're part of this system too.
Which is pretty bold for a social scientist.
It is. And that brings us right to the core argument of poverty by America.
Which is?
Fundamentally, he says poverty is a relationship. It's about exploitation. It doesn't just happen. It persists because the systems we have, things like low wages, super high rents, predatory financial services, they actively funnel wealth away from the poor towards the non-poor.
Okay, that's a strong claim.
Sure.
That the affluent actively create poverty. I mean, doesn't that risk just making people defensive?
Yeah.
How does he back that up against the idea that, you know, this is just how markets work?
Well, his defense is basically a mountain of data. He argues it's not just neglect or natural market forces. He points to specific, deliberate policies designed to extract wealth. And yeah, he is targeting comfortable, educated readers, people who might benefit from these systems without even realizing it through, say, their tax breaks or the low prices they enjoy or even where they choose to live.
So the goal isn't just small fixes.
No, he calls for poverty abolition. He wants to fundamentally change the rules of the game. He's saying, look, stop blaming the poor for their situation and start examining how the rest of us benefit from the way things are structured.
Right. Let's get into those structures then. He breaks it down into a few key mechanisms, right? Starting with work.
Exactly. The first big one is what he calls undervalued work. And right away, he tackles that myth that poor people are lazy.
Yeah, the data just doesn't support that at all.
No. Labor force participation among the poor is actually really high. People are working incredibly hard, often juggling multiple jobs. But the problem is, for like 50 years now, work just hasn't paid enough to live on for millions of people.
And he argues this is about power.
Right.
A power imbalance.
Absolutely. He details how worker power has been systematically weakened. Think about the decline of unions, for example, and the minimum wage. It's stagnated. It's lost a huge amount of its purchasing power compared to inflation.
So low wages aren't some kind of economic inevitability?
No, he frames them as a choice, a political and economic choice that boosts corporate profits. And maybe more uncomfortably for us, it provides cheaper goods and services for consumers who are better off.
So when you get a bargain,
Desmond essentially says you might be benefiting from a hidden subsidy, one paid by the underpaid worker who made or served that thing.
Wow. Okay, so if work isn't paying enough, where does that limited income actually go? That leads to his next point, right? Housing.
Yes. The squeeze, as he calls it. Housing instability isn't just something that happens to poor people. He argues it's a major cause of poverty itself.
Because people are paying so much of their income on rent.
A huge amount, often 50% or even more. It makes it impossible to save anything, leaves people incredibly vulnerable to the smallest unexpected expense, a car repair, a medical bill.
And it's not just high rents in general. He says affluent communities actively maintain this situation.
Yeah, this is where he gets into exclusionary zoning. This is a really crucial mechanism he identifies. It's a form of what he calls opportunity hoarding.
Okay, break that down. What is exclusionary zoning?
It's basically local laws used by wealthier towns or neighborhoods. Things like banning the construction of multifamily homes,
yeah,
or, you know, apartment buildings, or requiring huge minimum lot sizes for houses.
Ah, so it keeps density low and property values high.
Exactly. It artificially restricts the housing supply in areas with good schools, good jobs, safe streets. This drives up property values for the people who already live there, which they like.
Sure.
But it effectively builds a wall around those opportunities, keeping lower-income people out. It forces them into areas with less opportunity, often with substandard housing and still high rents because demand is concentrated there.
It's like creating a protective bubble for the affluent, funded by limiting options for others.
That's a good way to put it. And the extraction of wealth doesn't end there. He moves on to the financial system. He calls this the fleece.
The fleece. Okay. This is about the poverty tax.
Yeah, the idea that just being poor costs you money. If you don't have enough for a regular bank account or good credit, you're often forced to rely on really predatory services.
Like payday lenders?
Payday lenders, auto title loans. These places charge astronomical interest rates, sometimes 300%, 400% APR, or even higher. It's a system designed to strip wealth away.
And even for people who do have bank accounts.
If you're living paycheck to paycheck, you're much more likely to get hit with huge overdraft fees. Desmond shows how these fees basically function like short-term, very high-interest loans that people don't even ask for.
And that money goes straight to the banks.
Billions of dollars. It's a direct transfer of wealth from the most financially vulnerable people to the financial industry.
Okay, undervalued work, the housing squeeze, the financial fleece. But then he points to the government's role in all this.
Yes. This is maybe the most explosive part of the book. Chapter 7, he calls it Welfare for the Well-Off. It's about the upside-down welfare state.
The upside-down welfare state. Let's unpack that because it sounds counterintuitive. We think of welfare as checks or food stamps for the poor.
Right. But Desmond argues, using government data, that the largest government subsidies don't flow down to the poor. They flow up to the wealthy and the middle class, primarily through the tax code, through things called tax expenditures.
Tax expenditures?
Yeah.
What are those exactly?
Think of them like hidden government spending. Instead of the government sending someone a check, it just doesn't collect taxes it otherwise would, thanks to deductions, credits, and loopholes.
Argue like tax breaks.
Exactly. And these tax breaks overwhelmingly benefit higher earners.
Can you give some examples? What are the big ones?
The really big ones he highlights are the mortgage interest deduction, which lets homeowners deduct the interest they pay on their mortgages from their taxes and tax breaks for things like retirement savings accounts, like 401ks, and college savings plans, those 529 plans.
And these mainly help people who already own homes or have extra money to save for retirement or college.
Precisely. And the scale is just staggering. This is what really blew my mind. The amount the government spends or forgoes in revenue on just the mortgage interest deduction, for example, absolutely dwarfs the amount spent on direct housing assistance for low-income families.
Wow. So it's like 4 or 5 times as much.
Easily, depending on the year, yeah. His point is the government is spending massive amounts of money, hundreds of billions a year, to subsidize housing and savings. It just channels the vast majority of that support upwards, not downwards.
So the argument isn't that the government can't afford to help the poor more.
No, the argument is the government is already spending huge sums. It's just choosing who to help. And it disproportionately helps those who are already comfortable, reinforcing their advantages.
That completely reframes the debate about government spending or handouts.
It really does. He's saying the system isn't broken. It's functioning exactly as intended to benefit the affluent.
Okay, that's a lot to take in. Let's try to pull out some core themes here. What are the big takeaways you see?
I think the first major theme is poverty is exploitation, not scarcity. It's not that there isn't enough wealth to go around. It's about how the rules are written to allow some to capture more by taking from others.
Right. And that really changes how you might think about everyday things.
Right.
like you see super low prices at a store. Is that just efficiency? Or is it maybe enabled by wages that are too low somewhere down the line?
Exactly. The second theme, and this is the uncomfortable one, is the complicity of the affluent.
Yeah, this is the mirror he holds up.
It's that realization that, you know, maybe my rising home value, which I feel good about, is connected to zoning laws that prevent affordable housing nearby, making it harder for someone else to find a stable place to live.
We benefit from the system, even if we don't consciously think about it that way.
Mm-hmm. We participate in maintaining it.
Okay, so exploitation, complicity. Is there anything hopeful in here?
Yes, absolutely. The third theme, I think, is actually quite hopeful. Poverty is a solvable policy choice.
Meaning it doesn't have to be this way.
Exactly. It fights against that feeling of fatalism, that poverty is just too big or too complex to fix. If the government actively subsidizes the wealthy through these hidden mechanisms, it demonstrates the capacity to act.
Yeah.
It could choose to redirect that support, to rewrite the rules.
The systems were built so they could be rebuilt.
Precisely.
The book also has some really memorable lines, doesn't it? Phrases that stick with you.
Oh, definitely. He's a powerful writer. One of the key ideas that jumps out is, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice.
That's powerful. It shifts the goalpost, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's not just about making everyone rich or even relying on charity. It's about making the underlying system fair.
Right. Fixing the rules of the game. Then there's that direct challenge we mentioned. We are not simply observers of poverty, we are participants in it.
Yeah, that one lands hard. It demands we look at how we benefit from the current arrangement. That makes us participants, whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm. And another really provocative idea is his take on opportunity hoarding. He talks about the common middle-class decision to move to a certain neighborhood for the good schools.
Which sounds like a responsible thing for a parent to do.
Of course. But Desmond reframes it as a political act. By concentrating resources, good schools, safe parks, strong tax bases in affluent areas, often protected by those exclusionary zoning laws, it actively drains resources and opportunities away from poorer communities.
So it perpetuates the divide, even if that's not the individual's intention.
That's his argument. It maintains these deep class and often racial divides.
Okay, so if we accept this diagnosis that poverty is systemic, that we're involved, what does Desmond suggest we actually do? How do we become what he calls a poverty abolitionist?
Well, he says it starts by moving beyond just charity, although charity isn't bad. But we need to focus on changing the structures.
So on an individual level,
he suggests making more conscious ethical choices. For example, think about where your money is. Maybe bank with a local credit union instead of a huge national bank that makes billions from overdraft fees charged mostly to low-income customers.
Supporting businesses that pay living wages.
Yes. Trying to patronize businesses that treat their workers well and allow them to organize.
And then there's action beyond our own wallets. Civic action.
Right. Especially at the local level. He urges people to fight against NIMBYism that not in my backyard, resistance to affordable housing.
So showing up to town meetings, advocating for denser housing, challenging those exclusionary zoning laws.
Exactly. Even if it feels uncomfortable because it might affect your own property value perception. It's about creating more integrated communities where opportunity isn't hoarded.
And then at the bigger systemic level.
It comes down to politics. Informed voting, supporting policies, and politicians who are serious about tax fairness, potentially rolling back some of those huge tax breaks for the wealthy.
Strengthening worker power, maybe through supporting unions.
Definitely. And significantly boosting the social safety net. He talks a lot about things like expanding the child tax credit, making it more universal, things that directly put money into the hands of families who need it most.
So as we wrap up this deep dive,
mm-hmm.
Wow. It's a challenging book. It leaves you thinking differently about, well, pretty much everything.
It really does. For me, the thing that was most surprising, or maybe just crystallizing, was seeing the actual numbers behind that upside-down welfare state.
The sheer scale of it.
Yeah, the quantitative proof that America does engage in massive social spending, it just directs it upwards through the tax code. It completely dismantles the argument that we can't afford to do more about poverty. We clearly can. We just choose not to prioritize it that way.
That really hit me, too. And I think what resonated most for me was that fundamental shift he demands. From thinking about poverty through the lens of charity to thinking about it through the lens of justice. It feels less like a depressing account of an intractable problem and more like, I don't know, a hopeful manifesto. Because if poverty is a policy choice, then we can make different choices.
It puts the power back in our hands, collectively.
Yeah. It suggests ending poverty isn't some impossible dream. It's an achievable goal if enough people, especially those who benefit from the current system, commit to changing the rules. It demands political action, not just sympathy.
It's a call to become abolitionists.
A powerful call. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.